Extract from the Light in Britain. Of Grace, 1892-1979, and Ivan Cook, died in 1981. Foreword. Our purpose in this book is to reveal something of the pure and holy light, which ancient brotherhoods in Britain have left as our heritage and for our blessing, a light which, as in the age-old legend of King Arthur and his knights, lies dormant, only waiting to break forth to inspire and lead the people to victory over the darkness of materialism. Introduction. My wife's powers of seership first manifested during her childhood, and her life since has been largely dedicated to their development and establishment, to their testing and proving. Her name, Grace Cook, will be familiar to a wide circle, through the many books of the White Eagle Publishing Trust. In particular, another book of hers, The Illumined Ones, should be recognized as this book's forerunner, in that it also delves into a period perhaps 10,000-20,000 years ago, and recounts her memory of a life she herself lived as a Mayan girl. This story is told with simplicity and charm, but with an admixture of the wise and deep philosophy taught and practiced by the ancient Mayas, who at that period were a simple, happy race and brotherly in all their ways. The wise and great Hiawatha of those days, whom she describes as her father, is that same White Eagle who has been her companion and spiritual teacher throughout her present life and through many incarnations, and whose wisdom illumines this present book. The name itself is symbolic of a spiritual teacher, a messenger. The story in The Illumined Ones keys in, as it were, with the light in Britain in another way also, because the ancients, contrary to general belief, mingled freely, voyaged freely across the oceans, and were citizens not only of their country but of their world, and may well have touched the shores of Britain. So it is to the very ancient British people, perhaps of an earlier humanity and living in a wiser, kindlier, more sensible and brotherly world, that this our book would seek to introduce its readers. It is the story of a light dwelling in the heart of Britain and her people. Also, what my wife and I want very much to feel is that our reader is ready to share in this quest with us, ready in imagination to climb the downlands, to feel their wholesomeness and power, to respond to their spirit and message. We want to pursue this quest together. So whenever in future the pronoun we occurs, it is meant to include our reader, even if you feel distrustful at first about the revelations of seership. We shall grow closer during our journey, closer than you might think, and who knows, might presently climb to heights most blessed upon our chalk downs, and reach and find an aloneness set high between heaven and earth, where larks sing and sweet grasses and herbs scent the pure winds. Here shall we find the secret of Britain's lost heritage waiting for us to rediscover, waiting to reveal itself. Together we set off. Grace Cook begins the story. This is a story of adventure, and of an investigation by somewhat unorthodox methods into the ancient heritage of this mystic isle of Britain. One bright summer day in early June 1966, my husband, myself and Jenny, our granddaughter, set off in happy anticipation to explore the beauties of some of the English chalk downland, in high hopes that we should learn something more concerning the kind of life lived by the ancient Britons. Many years before, I had been deeply impressed by an article in one of the daily papers describing excavations and discoveries then being made at Avebury in Wiltshire, of what was thought to be a sun temple of considerable antiquity. The writer of the article said that when the excavations and restorations were complete, and all the huge stones re-erected, the ancient temple would prove to be grander and more impressive than any known Egyptian temple. A diagram showed the plan of these ancient stones as they might look when re-erected in their original positions. Excited by what I read then, my family and I had set off to explore Avebury. It proved to be a medley of immense monoliths scattered over many acres of the countryside, some of the stones actually standing in the gardens of the cottages of Avebury. About a mile distant from the village, close to the Bath Road, stood a strange artificial hill known as Silbury Hill. We now know that this inexplicable hill, with a base covering several acres, and rising from a flat meadow, has defeated all the archaeological experts right up to the present day in their effort to find any explanation for its existence. Then, it was all strange to us, and we knew nothing of its fame. I felt a magnetic attraction towards this hill. It was drawing me, and I wanted to climb to the top and hastened to do so. Once up there, a magnificent view of the surrounding countryside opened out, but most striking to me was a bird's eye view of the lines of stones of Avebury, which looked as though they had first been laid out in the form of a curving serpent. From above it was apparent that many of the larger stones were missing, but sufficient of the smaller monoliths remained to give me the impression that this may have been the site of some so-called serpent worship of prehistoric time, about which I had once read. We felt a power so strong that we had to linger at the top. For some reason, in spite of the cold March day, it no longer felt cold or blustery. Gradually my etheric vision awakened and I saw that the area about the hill was filled with nature spirits of all kinds, and I realized that I was watching a ceremony of the rogation or the blessing of the seeds taking place, which seemed to call forth a great deal of sound and movement on the etheric plane. I could also see many women and children at the foot of the hill, busily sowing the seeds. Then I felt a tremendous heat all around me on the hilltop and saw with amazement an immense altar upon which a great flame arose. It burned quite unlike any ordinary fire, for it seemed to need no replenishment, and I felt that it had been burning there in the etheric world for unmeasured time. Great beings who seemed to be the high priests were serving at this altar. Strangely enough, the impression given to me was that some of these people on the hill were, or had once been, Indians, with feathered headdresses, and that others were of the Egyptian race. Some years after this unforgettable experience, my memory was once again stirred, and I was able to look back into my own past and see myself as a South American Indian girl. I am convinced that there is a link between what I saw on Silbury and the very ancient Mayan civilization in which I once lived. I am sure that many of the etheric beings and spirits that I saw had once been American Indians. Their dress and their mode of perambulation around the hill, their method of directing the white rays across the fields and plains were similar to the dress worn and ceremonies practiced by the Indians who lived in the foothills of the Andes so many, many years ago. I have been led increasingly to believe that this ceremony so clearly shown to me in the precincts of the ancient serpent worship temple near Avebury, was originally introduced into Britain by those South American Indians who had much knowledge of etheric life. They in turn were controlling and directing an army of agricultural workers on the plains below, by what appeared to me to be remote, telepathic or even automatic control. Also I saw many etheric people assisting the men and women below, while the priests standing by the altar were directing onto the earth streams of white light, nourishment drawn from the ether for dressing the newly sown land. While this ceremony was in progress, there appeared those whom I felt to be planetary visitors coming from outer space to share in what was really a festival in celebration of the vernal equinox. Normally we should have been shivering by now on any hilltop on such a bitterly cold day, but personally I felt that I was bathed in warmth, as though the sun were blazing down on me. This vision on Silbury Hill stirred other memories deep in my soul, memories which had hardly taken form but which made me resolve that later on, when the threat of war had ceased, and we could move freely and perhaps spend more time in quiet contemplation, we would revisit this strangely attractive spot. Thus on a lovely June day in 1966 we again set forth, not only to investigate the mysteries of Avebury, but to visit other prehistoric sites, which from my inner knowledge I now believe to be connected with an ancient brotherhood of sainted people, members of a race, which once lived in Britain. We planned to stay in Marlborough, a favorite center from which to visit the famous White Horse of Uffington on the Berkshire Downs, and then go on to Wayland Smithy, where, according to our guidebook, we should find a dolmen or burial chamber. From here we would travel on to Avebury, and later to the Rollright Stones in the Cotswolds. We spent some time in meditation at each of these ancient centers, in the course of which I was taken back in memory, in awareness, to religious rituals enacted at these places in ages long past. And as I described these etheric scenes, Jenny, our granddaughter, recorded it in shorthand. Here I must explain that all physical form has its etheric counterpart, and that all human life and thought impresses itself on the ether or the etheric emanation from the physical life of our earth. The life a man leads leaves an impression on the ether around him. Even the commonplace, the ordinary life, leaves such an impression, if any life is ever ordinary. But where some wise and kind man has lived and worked, the impression remains forever. Thus the lives of all the ancient peoples who once walked the earth are indelibly impressed upon the ether in records, which can be tapped and brought to life by the trained clairvoyant. These were the records I was reading when we sat in meditation at these ancient centers, and I recounted what I saw for Jenny to record. Now let my husband take over the story. 2. Trackway into the magical land. Those who desire to receive accurately from the higher worlds must learn to discipline their minds, to preserve tranquility and quietude of the soul. Must learn to move harmoniously, quietly, obediently, through life. Then only will they reflect truth, think and speak truth, and live truth. W.E. In fancy we have climbed high and are now walking along the Great Ridgeway, one of the oldest roads in our land. We do not know how many generations of men have trodden this ancient trackway, and died in this Britain of ours. What we call ancient history only reaches back a few thousand years and is based on findings of the bones of men, their bits of pottery and domestic tools, and the discovery of even earlier relics such as the fossilized bones of semi-tropical animals. We know from these, that Britain once possessed a warmer and more genial climate. But concerning the men and women of long ago, we know nothing except certain myths or folk tales that have come down to us. Someone once said that a myth is fossilized history folk tale, which has become embedded in the race and has come down perhaps through countless generations to acquire the semblance of a fairy tale, a fantasy, but a fantasy, which embodies deep and ancient truths. A trackway starts as far north as the Wash and as the Icknield Way traverses the great backbone of the Chilterns, and so to the Berkshire Downs where an ancient track links it with that great ridgeway, which follows the crest of the Berkshire and Marlborough Downs from Streatley to Overbury, skirts Salisbury Plain, with arms reaching out to touch Stonehenge and many another centre of ancient worship, and then onward, ever winding up and down to finish in Devonshire. High above the swamps and forests which, in days far gone, formed the greater part of Britain, this noble trackway strode across the hills, while many generations of men, our own spiritual ancestors, walked along it, spent their whole being amid those hills, and loving them also loved each other. They intermarried and brought forth children, and in all their aspirations, hopes and fears, which comprise human life, the trackway shared. And because it has known these deep human feelings, they are implanted in its substance, have become part of its very being, giving it atmosphere, so that whoever walks the trackway and breathes its atmosphere will know that these thoughts and feelings of long ago are as real as ours today, once one can respond to them. Of this trackway, H.J. Massingham wrote in the English Downland, apostrophe. The majesty of the great trackway is the threefold one of sight, of conception and of time. The ridgeway travelling the Berkshire Downs is the greatest, the lengthiest, and the noblest in appearance of all the prehistoric roads. It looks its part. In places 20 and often 40 yards and more in width, and bounded, though not all the way, by low tangled banks, by thorn, maple, spindle, black bryony and traveller's joy, spaced out at irregular intervals, or by short and occasional rows of beeches, it flows westwards in a series of mighty undulations towards Overbury, the London of the megalith builders. But it is unlike any of the Roman roads in Berkshire. Because it is always bending from the straight to circumvent the trouble the Romans gave themselves by pushing their will against every natural resistance. This double motion, absent from the Roman road, adds variety to its dignity, and seems to endow it with every grace and fluctuation of surface, which the downs possess. The old road is theirs, its movement is of their rhythm, its course a sensitive reaction to their forms. The great Ridgeway's natural affinity is more with the sky above it than with the valley from which its humbler consort is barely raised. The sky influence is in constant play with the surface of the downs, directly by the cloud shadows that stalk over it, and indirectly by the elevated plateau communicating the heavenly quality of spaciousness. It is an enlargement shared by the road in its breadth and easy movement and gestures of rise and fall, and by the human spirit that follows its trail. That spirit is assured of a silence deepened rather than broken by the winds and the purified voices of the skylarks, whose airy chain of syllables travels twice as far as in the plain. Encountering but one house, where the Wantage-Hungerford road severs the green way, the walker will be at home in a solitude that is never estranging, because the massiveness of curve and fold is accompanied by a gentleness in their structure whose meaning is welcome. Here are no crags to dwarf nor precipices to repulse the man among them, and the great road, man-made and at one with the downs, is the intermediary between human feeling and the high places its early deities once walked. A noble description of a noble road. Surely there must be few who can walk this great trackway untouched, unfeeling, without opening themselves to welcome its spirit and abiding power. This is a magical trackway. In Berkshire, high over the Little Dragon Hill at Uffington, one encounters strong and righteous magic. One can stand here where the steep hill falls directly away to the great horse long ago carved in the hillside chalk, which some say, and very reasonably, is no horse at all but represents a flying dragon, and look across this highly stylized beast down to the valley, to where beyond the village of Uffington, the land drops into that vast decline, which is the Thames Valley. And as we stand and gaze, we can feel not only the power of the ancient life bequeathed the memories that now stir within us, but also the possibility that we ourselves in some incarnation long ago once trod this green road and standing on this high place, ourselves looked down below White Horse Hill, and looking towards Uffington, is a smallish flat-topped hill, its base covering about an acre, quite obviously man-made, by men carrying earth up to its crown, how many generations ago no one knows. If you will climb and walk across that hilltop, you wonder why, although the soil seems fertile enough, there is a barren area where nothing will grow. No kind of turf will you find, nor yet flowers. Legend has it that here on this flat-topped hill our own Saint George fought long and desperately with the dragon and slew it, and that its blood, gushing forth, flooded that flat top, since when nothing green has ever grown there. Our folk stories, and indeed myths from all over the world, are charged with tales of fearful dragons, all representing evil in personified form, all breathing fire and destruction, all eager to kill innocence, integrity, fidelity and good intent. So in imagination we now stand and gaze, and ponder on the origin and meaning of these stories. We look back along the trackway, and perhaps there comes over us a feeling as of living long ago when the climate was warmer and more sensitive, when plants and fruits and crops flourished on these high downs. And then as we again look across the great valley of the Thames, behold, all is changed. Gone is Uffington village, gone are the orderly fields, the nestling woodlands, the gentle tree-lined countryside, and now before us, spread right across the valley, we see only pools of water and the slush of great swamps matted together, all full of shadow and threat of darkness, where one could only walk or creep through tunneled ways, ever shaded from the sky, giving no vista of the hills. Our thoughts come back for a moment to the present, and we wonder whether our own tunneled roads, and our, so to speak, tunneled lives spent in cities, were in some way a reflection of matted swamplands, and whether we have got into the habit, as our ancestors did, of choosing shaded ways in which to hide and live? Do we now somehow fear the vast spaces of the downs? Can this be true? Well, we have come to a place where mighty happenings have been wrought, and soon we are going to employ the power of clear vision, of clear seeing, that aspect of clear seeing, which is the power to investigate ancient truths of long ago, to re-establish them in the thought and mind, and possibly in the very being of man, so that he sees whence he came, and better, knows why he is here, and gets more than a glimpse, a hope, gets a firm belief as to whither he will go when his days in the flesh are ended. In short, this is a clear seeing which can reveal to a man a world, which although seeming disorderly, is in fact ordered and planned, with man's destiny clear before him, and the reason of his being and the way he should try to live. In this first message, statements will be made about the life of man in the long ago, when he lived to a far greater age, and during his span, say of 60 years, 6 by 20 = 120, acquired greater vision of the truth, greater wisdom, greater measure of health and strength, greater capacity to deal with the world about him than we who live only for half his period, never reaching to our full span of life or vigor, either mental or physical. These are some of the things we shall have to take in our stride for the moment. Each and all will come to be explained, to be given credence, become open to belief, although not all at once. For the moment, certain things will have to be taken on trust, and the reader will help himself by remaining open and receptive to new and perhaps strange ideas. The great Ridgeway, which stretched halfway across England in ancient times. In the valley to the left is the edge of the vast swampland, which is now the Thames Valley, artist's impression. 3. When the dragon was slain on Dragon Hill. There are centres in this mystic isle of Britain where a perfect light has been accumulating for centuries, centres where long ago sincere and holy brethren met to practice the mysteries. Upon them a blazing golden light poured down, and through them it impregnated the very earth itself. W.E. The three of us, my wife, Jenny and myself, are seated high on the Berkshire Downs hard by Arthington Castle, a great circular earthwork rising to nearly 1,000 feet, flanked by numerous barrows where the revered dead have been interred. We have edged away from the crowd, for this is a popular spot, and being away from the world, seem raised high above it, literally so, for the world lies flattened at our feet. Behind us Uffington Castle rises high against the skyline, and behind it again, runs the great trackway, smooth and green, carpeted, as it has been through the centuries, by fine well-trodden turf. Just below can be seen the white horse or dragon, the oldest known figure ever carved in the chalk in Britain. It is said to be 2,000 years old at least, and has been kept clear throughout the centuries. The countrymen used to sing. The arid white horse wants zet into rights, and the squire has promised good cheer, so we'll just a scrape to keep on in shape, and day'll last for many a year. All is very quiet. Jenny is waiting with a pencil and notebook ready, and the person most necessary is quietly opening the deeper levels within herself. She now responds to the atmosphere, to the all-pervading influence, to the surrounding ether and its record of the past ages. She sees what once happened as pictures, but alive pictures, that is to say, she is projected into the past so that it is real to her and she is living in it. It must be noted that not only in this, but in all the visionary experiences that follow, she will touch on many different periods and strata of human experience. Some of the visions go back to lives lived in an inconceivably distant past, and others are comparatively closer in time. In some, several different periods kaleidoscope. It will be noted also what a range of speculation and even revelation is opened up. Indeed, is not this place sufficient to inspire such a message, with the larks singing high above the chalk hills, and the scent of wild thyme upon the air? The famous Wiltshire White Horse. The White Horse and Dragon Hill. White Horse Hill, 5 miles west of Wantage. The sketchy figure of a horse, 37 feet long, cut in the turf on the hillside, is of unknown origin, but thought to be of great antiquity, probably late Iron Age. The hollow on the west face of the hill is known as the Manger, slightly to the north of which is a detached knoll called Dragon Hill, where, according to local tradition, Street George slew the dragon. The message begins. The dragon symbolizes darkness and evil, conquered by the power of the light. The legend of Street George and the dragon tells the same story. Saint George symbolizes the light, or Christ in man, and all that is good, the dragon all that is evil. There was a concentration of the light here to dispel the darkness. But first there was a terrific battle on the etheric plane between the forces of good and evil. This was an Atlantean colony. The dark priests from Atlantis gained knowledge of destructive power, which could have destroyed the earth. There was a concentration of the dark power set up here, which had tea. I can now see a great open-air temple there below. I can see a procession of people with torches, proceeding round and round, enacting a ceremony to invoke the light to penetrate the darkness centered on Dragon's Hill. A great battle took place between these dark forces and the light, a battle which manifested right through onto the physical plane, where there was bloodshed and carnage. The people of the light came from far to bring the light to the young souls, who would have none of it. Then followed the battle. I feel that all around this hill was water and marshland where swamp people lived, while the people of the light lived on the surrounding hills high above the darkness. They fought and won the battle with darkness and ignorance. The dragon was slain, and Dragon Hill purified by their invocation of the light. On these hills an observatory was built, from which the people of the light watched the heavens. They were not ignorant, but very knowledgeable, particularly about the etheric worlds. They were the true Britons. They were not called Britons then, but were known by another name. I can now see Dragon Hill ablaze with gold. It has become a hill of gold. This place has to do with the serpent. I can see the people processing in the form of a serpent. I can hear the rhythmic tramp, tramp, tramp and music working up to a crescendo as the people perambulate round the hill, singing and bearing blazing torches. This was an age-old magical rite, a celebration of the triumph of the light over the dragon of evil, which arises out of ignorance. The white horse on the hill is really the symbol of the dragon, commemorating this battle between the forces of light and darkness. Sometime after this experience above Dragon Hill, I turned up yet another description, this time of my wife's first visit, in October 1949. It is interesting to see how far the two messages corroborate one another. The 1949 message reads, "We climbed up past Dragon Hill, past the shape of the horse or dragon cut into the side of White Horse Hill, to the castle above, and stood facing the great valley of the Thames with its horizon of hills. The sun was a deep gold as it set in a cloudless sky, casting a soft amethyst light over the hills and valleys, which in the distance changed to the soft blue that to me symbolizes the great Mother Spirit. It was a wonderful scene even on the physical plane. But as I went into meditation, my inner vision slowly opened and I saw a great assembly of simply clad people filling the amphitheater or manger below Dragon Hill, and heard the sound of trumpets, summoning the people to take part in some grand ceremony of sun worship. I saw then that 12 high priests were conducting the ritual now taking place on Dragon Hill, and they appeared to be summoning the great angels of the white light. For in the white ether which was now rising from above the altar, they were using the hill as an altar. I saw especially angels, which I thought were from other planets, and around the hill itself there seemed to be a host of lesser nature spirits, sylphs and salamanders, gnomes and other fairy forms. They too, with the people, seemed to move round the base of the hill, encircling it many times. While they did so, I saw an ever-rising spiral of golden light. Presently the ritual rose to a kind of crescendo, called forth by the chanting people. They seemed to glow with light, while the radiation appeared as a fountain of light, rising and spreading out over the surrounding countryside so that a golden radiance fell on the earth. I felt that a great being was enveloped within this light and thought it might be the Christ form. The form gradually became more definite, and then I saw another being appear who seemed like a king, wearing a crown of gold and robed in light, with the points of that crown emitting rays of great brilliance.